Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have Lynn Cheney with us this hour. We love doing presidential histories, and she has written just a wonderful book about James Madison, our fourth president. The New York Times Review said that apart from Ralph Lewis Ketchum's 1971 life, this is probably the best single-volume biography of Madison that we know. He had a fascinating life. Of course, he was married to Dolly, and I think more books have been written about Dolly lately than about James Madison. But what a time in which he lived, what a mind he had. He was so influential in writing the Bill of Rights and crafting the Constitution in just so many different areas, working with George Washington and very good friends with Thomas Jefferson and urging Jefferson, helping him with his campaign for the presidency. Well, we have a lot to talk about with Lynn Cheney. The book is James Madison, A Life Reconsidered. And Lynn has Wisconsin ties. She received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is author or co-author of 12 books, including 6 bestsellers about American history for children and their families. She, of course, knows Washington very well. She is the wife of former Vice President Dick Cheney, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Lynn Cheney as we talk about James Madison. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Lynn Cheney, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, especially since you are a history buff.
I love history, and I love presidential history. Abraham Lincoln is my favorite, I must say.
I can see why.
Yeah, I grew up in Illinois, and he is. But this Madison is not written about as much. I think I've done more interviews on Dolly, actually, than James Madison lately. But what a mind he had, how important he was, and to be born at that particular time with that kind of political mind and great concentration on politics, you couldn't have been born in a better epoch, right?
You know, I think most of the founders understood that they had a chance to be the founders of a nation and, to live on in human memory after they were dead. And they called it fame, which we kind of look at as a derogatory word and goal. But, you know, they saw it as something noble and understood that they had been given a great chance to do grand deeds.
And he was lucky. You remind us, I'm always interested in people's early lives. His father had sent him to fine schools. He really didn't need to think about having to work for a living because he had time to study, to practice politics, and really not to have to get a job early on, right?
Well, his father was still alive and running Montpelier in the early years of Madison's career. So you're right, he didn't have to earn a living. Once Montpelier became his, then he was in charge of running or at least seeing to the plantation's work. And that was no small task. I think we kind of... The modest framers, or the framers being modest, often refer to themselves as farmers, but this was farming on a really large scale, which was probably not bad training for running the country that was going to be on a large scale.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, you have said that you wanted to clear up the misconceptions about James Madison, it's time to recover his fine reputation, which has gotten lost over the past two centuries. Why has it been lost?
A couple of stereotypes have taken hold, one of them being that he was sickly, and you can't really reconcile that idea with everything he achieved. He was not only the father of the Constitution and the primary author of the Bill of Rights, and he ran all over the country, or rather took his horse and carriage all over the country to make sure the Constitution came about. And he also then went on to be the chief person in the Congress, Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of State, president himself for 8 years. And during that time, the country went to war for the first time under the Constitution. So he had an enormous amount of energy.
Another war that we don't really know very much about either. You know, how many people know much about the War of 1812? Let's talk about this sickness. I found those parts of the book, Lynn, very, very interesting, what the perception was of of epilepsy, how we blamed women for children who had this, and how it really did affect him in terms of not being able to go to Europe because he thought he might get sick, what kinds of drugs were given to treat epilepsy, and how it was thought of as being a sin, really.
Yes, that was the way that the mystery unraveled itself to me, the idea that people had that he was sickly, but that he also had these amazing accomplishments that involved a lot of energy. After doing a great deal of research, it seemed clear that he was debilitated from time to time with epileptic seizures, but he wasn't sickly. You know, he would have a seizure, and they were usually, and perhaps always, I'm not sure, of a milder kind, not a kind that threw you to the floor and made you suffer and writhe, but of a kind that, as he described it, suspended the intellectual senses. So he had these seizures from time to time. They did not make his life easy, but they allowed him also to expend great energy when he wasn't affected. So that was the mystery to unravel, and there are all sorts of interesting things. As you say, that the medicines, which you can identify by a memo his grandmother wrote asking for medicines for an epilepsy, you know, they involved all sorts of things that we don't think of today in terms of treating an ailment of the nervous system. And there was also a letter that he wrote at the end of his presidency in which he talked, and this letter had not been published at the time. I found it at Princeton University, or that's where I read it, in which he himself says that he suffered from something resembling epilepsy that lifted the intellectual senses.
Did it keep the first woman he fell in love with and asked to marry him, did it keep her from marrying him?
It might have. It's hard to know, but he was certainly in love with this woman named, young woman named Kitty Floyd. And given the fact that epilepsy was regarded as sin, that it was regarded as a sign of demonic possession, it could well have. There's no exact indication what happened, but something happened, and she suddenly turned in another direction.
But as you remind us, at least she said no, so we could all be entertained and graced by Dolly.
I know. She's so much fun to write about.
Yeah, I bet.
When I was working on the book, I would every once in a while look to see how many chapters until I got to Dolly.
she was great. Something. She was something.
Well, she, you know, she was, she understood a way in which spouses could be politically useful. And James was a great intellect, and everyone admired him for that. He was also a person who was warm and congenial in a small group, or, you know, when you talk to him with two or three people around. So Dolly would invite people to her house and feed them Southern comfort food. And, you know, I'm sure she directed them to where James was standing by the fireplace so they would begin to know better how warm and congenial he was. This was especially important then. They were living in Washington. James was Secretary of State, and he had his eye on the presidency. The nominees for the presidency would be decided by the caucuses in Congress. So she made sure that James had a very favorable presentation to them.
There is a portrait. There are some great portraits in your book, and there's one of him. I mean, the portraits are lovely, I think, of him, and you describe it as a portrait which hints at kindness his friends constantly attributed to him.
I think that's right. Dolly chose very well. She was a glamorous woman. She had been widowed with a little boy. But nevertheless, maybe even her attraction to her first husband had been because of her political or her beauty and her sensibility. But certainly men in the Philadelphia streets stopped when she walked by. There's contemporary testimony to that. Mm-hmm. So she was beautiful and warm and outgoing. I think James's attraction, he was a small man, fit, compact, but he was, I think it was the force of his personality that probably attracted her. The deep kindness that you mentioned, is something that would have been very valuable to her since she was a mother and she had a little son.
Right. And I would imagine it might serve you well in politics as well, huh?
Well, certainly she served him well by helping people know the underlying goodness of his character.
When did he realize, was it a professor, was it extensive reading which he did, that we had to separate from Britain?
Well, he went through, I think, the same experience that others did, which, you know, for the longest time was of respect for the British Constitution, pride in being a British colony. But then, you know, the slayings at Concord happened. British besieged Boston. Before that, even, you had the Boston Tea Party. The Virginians were the most supportive of the people in Massachusetts and around Boston when the British laid down, invaded the city, really. So I think for him it was a gradual journey. If you couldn't be a person whose rights were as fully respected as all other persons in the Commonwealth, then what was the point? America should be independent.
And you begin the book, what's the date you begin it?
It's 1787.
May of 1787, and he's at essentially a boarding house where he's been for a long, long period of time. You get this sense from your book that he's been working on these matters of states, and what a huge job to fashion a country with all of his mind and all of his heart for such a long period of time and sacrificing pretty much anything else in life.
He was a hard worker. There's just a little note that betrays so much. A cousin of his was visiting Montpelier, and he noticed that while everyone else was socializing after dinner, that James went to his room to work.
Oh, my gosh.
What he was doing was reading, and Thomas Jefferson helped out by sending him many trunks full of books from Paris, where Jefferson was representing the country. And so he read and read and was particularly interested in the time leading up to the Constitution about how a republic, a representative government, should organize itself. He was probably the best prepared man, you know, in the world at the time of the Constitutional Convention to help write a governing framework for the country.
And how important was he in determining what was going to be in that governing framework, Lynn, and in the Bill of Rights?
Well, he arrived at the convention with the agenda for it. Sometimes we teach kids it's called the Virginia Plan. But essentially it was the agenda. You know, it set forth the points to be considered and suggested directions that might be taken. He didn't get everything he wanted. In fact, at the end of the convention, he was disappointed that he hadn't gotten everything he wanted. But he understood that he had gotten a great deal, and that it was crucial to go forward with the Constitution that the delegates presented to the country.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about, and it made me think about, after the Civil War, when the country, you know, fell apart for such a period of time, that the Constitution survived and the amendments survived, and you think about the whole host of amendments dealing with slavery and women's suffrage, et cetera, that could take place, you know, in large measure because of Madison's work on all of that, right?
Yes, and the idea of amending the Constitution did not appeal to him at all until it was ratified. That is, until enough states had said, yes, it's signed with us, that it was in effect. He was so smart politically. He understood, you know, if you tried to amend it before that, that, in fact, the suggestion of amendments and the fact of amending itself would become barriers to it being ratified. You know, one state might say, well, I want this, and ratify it, and then other states would have to change. So he held off, even on a Bill of Rights, until the document was ratified. And then he became the chief advocate for a Bill of Rights and for the setting the pattern for amendment later.
I always like to talk about slavery because it's interesting to see where the founding fathers were on this issue. You write that he believed it was, quote, the most oppressive dominion ever exercised by man over man, but realized the political opposition was too great and hoped that time would resolve the issue.
It was, you know, they were in a particular dilemma. Slavery was clearly wrong. It was morally wrong. But if they had that fight in 1787, the Constitution wouldn't be put in place. A nation wouldn't be created. So, you know, I think that given that particular dilemma, they did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Madison agonized over it, and I feel pained when I have to say that because slavery is such a grievous wrong against another human being.
How many slaves were there at Montpelier?
Oh, gosh. 100 is a figure that comes to mind. One of the interesting things that is happening at Madison's home is that it has been undergoing an amazing renovation. It was purchased for a while by Miriam Scott DuPont, and she added wings and put stucco of kind of peach color over it, you know, really renovated it according to her taste. And that was all fine, but we didn't have any idea what Montpelier was like until this renovation that I think was completed about 5 years ago went into place. It's just, I would urge all your listeners, if they are in the Virginia area, to go to Montpelier. One of the interesting things they're doing now is reconstructing slave cabins.
Oh, really?
And what is just fascinating is how close they are to the mansion. You know, Madison would have heard the slave children playing and heard singing when people were singing, and no doubt could smell the smells of the slave women cooking. That is in such great contrast, and this is what fascinates me, to Jefferson, who hid the slaves.
Hmm.
You know, he put them in this place at Montpelier where you couldn't really see their quarters, and he devised all these dumb waiters and so on so that you wouldn't have to, see the slave effort that had gone into things. It really is revealing of a difference between the two men, Madison being just sort of more plain and just putting things out there. Well, Jefferson didn't want people to see, and Jefferson, too, understood slavery was wrong. He didn't want them to see anything that, you know, they might feel was unpleasant, recognizing that, you know, slavery offended people, as it well should have.
And little did he realize, perhaps, that we would years later realize that he had a child.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And the founders, you know, we sometimes think of them as people sitting around a table having a polite conversation, but they were real human beings and had real what were regarded then and I think still now as scandals in their lives.
Let's go back a few generations. Madison's ancestors, his great-great-grandfather, you write, John Madison, left England in the middle of the 17th century, entering Chesapeake Bay with 11 men whose passages he had paid so that he might get head rights. What were head rights?
Well, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. I think it's 50 acres.
Uh-huh.
And so if you paid someone's way here, you got land. The king had this arrangement. And then the person whose way you had paid had to serve you for a number of years, 4 to 7, I believe it was. And so that was a way to obtain land and indentured servants to work the land. That was the economy of Virginia for a very long time until the land began to grow more scarce and the opportunities in England grew better. Then it was harder to find indentured servants, and that's when slavery came into being. People were needed to work the land, and so when the supply of indentured servants was drying up, people began to purchase slaves.
And the Madisons obviously must have, I think you say, they got they owned eventually thousands of acres of land.
Yes. Well, part of the reason for that is that tobacco destroys land. it deprives the soil of key nutrients. Nowadays, I suppose you could fertilize so that you could continue to grow. But in the time of the founding of the nation, what you had to do was move. You took the place you had planted and left it fallow and moved on, which meant you had to have a lot of acreage just to keep going.
You mentioned the differences between Madison and Jefferson. Tell me about their friendship, how fast friends they were, and the role that Madison played in helping Jefferson get elected.
Well, they simply were friends from the beginning to the end. We often talk about the friendship between Jefferson and Adams, you know, one that grew late in life. But now I think this one was more significant because it affected the course of the nation. The difference that I was talking about, you know, Madison sort of being grounded in reality and Jefferson kind of building up dreams and fantasies, which were enormously inspiring, but sometimes, you know, not grounded. The difference in the two men, I think, helped both of them. You know, Jefferson inspired Madison, and Madison kept Jefferson anchored to the real world, didn't let him, you know, fly off into the clouds. So that was part of the friendship, that they understood that they balanced one another, I believe. And certainly they were the smartest people. I mean, each was the smartest that the other ever knew. And they were very well educated. So they not only could have conversations of a high intellectual level, they could refer to the things that learned people at the time knew. And I think that made it a very rewarding engagement for both of them.
We're talking about James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, this hour of the program. And our guest is Lynn Cheney. She is author of James Madison, A Life Reconsidered. It was a bestseller in hardcover, and it's just out in paperback, where I'm sure it will also be another bestseller. It's very, very well researched. It's received terrific reviews and a thorough account of the president that perhaps we've overlooked and was incredibly important in the founding of this country. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. So we'll go to you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lynn Cheney is our guest this hour. Her book is James Madison, A Life Reconsidered. Tomorrow during this hour, we're going to lighten things up a bit and speak with the author of this really interesting book on Hollywood legends. So how about a little bit of gossiping about Katharine Hepburn, Johnny Carson, Frank Sinatra, Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward, Jane Fonda, Elizabeth Taylor, Audrey Hepburn, James Stewart, Betty Davis. The author of In the Company of Legends will be joining us tomorrow during this hour. In the first hour of the show, for those of you who like dolphins and who doesn't like dolphins, we're going to be speaking with somebody from National Geographic about the how smart they are and how they organize their societies. It should be fun. That's hour one of our show. All right, James Madison this hour, and let's go to John in Green Bay first. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon. I would like to tell our listeners about a wonderful article called Washington is Burning by Andrew Cogburn in Harper's Magazine of September 2014. It tells the story of the War of 18, a little bit of the War of 1812, when we went into Canada, we invaded Canada. And it was supposedly, Jefferson said that it would be a cakewalk, very much like some other wars that we've heard that it was going to be a cakewalk. And it also talks about a Mary Ellen Stewart, who was the property of Dolly Madison. She escaped one evening, but she was caught. And then some abolitionists bought her freedom. And I was just I had to call in because I was amazed when I heard the talk of the restoration of Madison's home and the slave quarters being so close that he could hear the happy slaves and the dancing slaves.
Thank you, John, for your call. Lynn Cheney.
Well, that sounds really interesting. There has been a lot of, I don't know, myth built up around the British burning of Washington. But one of my fond memories is when the Queen came to Washington. This was for an important anniversary of Jamestown. But because Dick was vice president, I had the honor of being among the group that went around the Capitol with her. And so the guide pointed out that you could still see some of the signs of burning. They still have big trusses in the Capitol where, you know, if you don't
really
to look, you can see where it was burned. And the Queen was not at all amused. And she said, "Well, you did burn York." And I think that's the name for Toronto. I'm not sure. But her point was, is you invaded Canada, you caused a lot of problems. So, you know, she was a little frosty about it. Maybe joking, but I didn't think so.
Yeah, I think you probably would know if she was joking. What precipitated the War of 1812?
It sometimes is called the Second War of Independence. And the reason it's called that is because the British were treating us as though we had never had a revolution and become an independent country. They were in a war, and they needed troops to man their ships. So one of the issues that was most irritating was that they stopped American ships and took sailors off of them, that they had even any suspicion of being British. And, of course, in a lot of cases, they weren't. They were seizing our own sailors and impressing them into their navy. So it was that kind of insult that it went on for years and years. It was widely believed, and I think in many instances was true, that the British encouraged Indians, as they were called in those days, Native Americans, to ally with them and to attack white settlers. Now, of course, in truth, the Native Americans probably didn't need a lot of encouragement, since white settlers were invading, in essence, their territory. But that was another thing, the whole idea about whom the frontier belonged to and the British challenge to that. So those were the factors leading up to the war.
And I guess I didn't know this, that Madison's Secretary of War, who must have been influential, didn't believe that the British would ever attack Washington, and certainly never thought that the British would, you know, burn the Capitol and burn the White House.
John Armstrong was a difficult man. I think he thought he should be president himself. And perhaps didn't have the respect for the chief executive talents that Madison did possess, and there were many. But he was just a pill, you know. He was always discouraging the idea that we needed to prepare for a British invasion of the capital. And he was insolent, and not if he did carry out orders, he would do it in a, you know, rather churlish fashion. It was, I think I say this in the book, or maybe this is just part of the speeches I sometimes give, even today, a good cabinet member is hard to find. Someone who, you know, suits the jobs very well, carries out the president's policies, has ideas that are useful to the larger cause. But Madison suffered through that. Remember, you love Lincoln, how a good general is hard to find.
Right. Right.
And Madison had that trouble as well. So finding the right people to help you out. Washington had that problem, too. But John Armstrong was among the worst.
But Washington had Madison. Madison wrote his first inaugural. Is that right?
Isn't that? That's
I didn't know that.
Story.
Yeah. What is the story?
Well, Madison wrote the president's inaugural address. Washington had first had someone else give it a try, and it was a disaster. So he called Madison, there you go, he wrote to Madison, asked him to come to Mount Vernon, and Madison did write the address. It was, in those days, it wasn't delivered as we expect it now, but it was presented to the Congress, And they, in turn, had to respond. So Madison wrote the response to the inaugural address. And Washington then asked Madison if he would write Washington's response back to the Congress. So when you think of the role Madison was playing, it was as though his voice was echoing off every wall.
Hmm, interesting way to put it. Thank you, John, for the call. Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Before I ask my question, I would like to make a comment. I'm currently working on as a volunteer on a project that is transcribing the registers from the poorhouse and the asylum from Monroe County from the end of the 1800s up through the Depression. And one of the more shocking elements, I mean, this stuff is fascinating, but one of the more shocking elements to me was the types of diagnoses in those days, and this is quite a bit later than Mr. Madison's era, obviously, that would get people into the asylum, and one of them was epilepsy. And another would
really
be like Huntington's chorea.
Mm,
you know,
yes.
Anything where they just, you know, they couldn't live in a normal setting, and of course they didn't have money, like as I guess Mr. Madison did, you know, to be cared for. Can you imagine having nothing wrong with your mind but having epilepsy and yet being in an asylum for probably the rest of your life?
Goodness.
Just horrific.
Really?
Well, thank you for that effort that you're undertaking. As I was writing this book, I was so grateful for the increased knowledge we have every day because people are saving records of the past. And one of the things that is really interesting about Montpelier is they're putting the slave experience into it. And there's deep research behind that, a lot of archaeology, as they determine where the cabins were, what the function of the cabins that they're rebuilding were, who lived there. You know, they have names so that you can honor individual people rather than just as a group. So it's a this kind of research is so inspiring to me.
Yeah, it's so important. You had a question, Scott?
Yeah, well, in fact, I'm so glad you brought up the slavery because that's exactly where I was going.
All right.
My question is, famously, George Washington freed his slaves upon his passing, and I guess equally famously or maybe infamously, Thomas Jefferson did not. So my question is, what happened to the slaves at Montpelier after the passing of, and I don't know who passed first, whether Dolly or James, but just do you know what wound up happening to those slaves after their deaths?
Well, freeing slaves, just let me provide a little context, became harder and harder as the century advanced. Virginia passed a law that you couldn't free a slave and have that slave remain in the state. So one of Madison's aides, an idealistic young man who I think owned 12 slaves, took them to Illinois, bought land, and freed them there. But by the time that the founders were passing on, Washington got in under the deadline, I believe. But by the time Madison was passing on, you couldn't even take them to a neighboring state because the neighboring states had passed laws. Now, that's no excuse for not freeing slaves, which Madison didn't, but it does provide a little context. Dolly inherited the estate and the people who sold slaves, they were professional slave sellers, came to Montpelier and sold the slaves. I mean, it's a very, very sad story.
Mm-hmm. And Dolly wound up in what you call genteel poverty. How did that happen?
Well, Washington was in financial trouble as he died, but the situation in Virginia became worse and worse. European wars, the price of grain, they all fell on extremely hard times. Jefferson signed a note for a friend of his, and the friend defaulted. So that threw Jefferson into a terrible state where he was trying to sell Monticello through a lottery. Madison had a stepson, that little boy of Dolly's, grew up and became a gambler and a wastrel, who cost him as much as Jefferson's friend had cost him. And so when Madison died, Montpelier was a financial wreck. So that's how Dolly became impoverished. one of the stories that is so moving is that there was a slave who had lived at the Madisons, whom Daniel Webster had bought and then freed. And when Dolly was at her poorest, when she was trying to pay back a loan of 75 cents, this slave would sometimes bring her food.
Thanks, Scott, so much. Always nice to hear from you. Harry in Madison, hi.
Yes, hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Harry.
Hi, morning, Mrs. Jenny.
How are you?
I have a couple of comments and a question. Mm-hmm. Madison was said to be sickly, and that's why he didn't go home and become a planter after he graduated from Princeton. And the question is, why in the first place did he go to Princeton since all the sons of the planters were going to Virginia? And then my second question is, can you talk a little bit about Madison's ideas about factions in Federalist 10 and Federalist 51?
Well, the issue with Princeton, and you're right, most of the Sons of Virginia planters went there, but there were, I think, many things. One was Madison had a tutor who'd gone to Princeton. And you know how that is. If someone you admire and someone who is telling you what a great school this is, mm-hmm. Is in close company with you, that's an influence. Secondly, the reputation of William and Mary had fallen on hard times. There was all sorts of talk about carousing and drinking and playing cards, and some of it involved the faculty. So that was a count against it. There was also a belief, and this would have had a special impact on Madison, that the climate at Williamsburg wasn't as good for a person's health as the climate farther north. And in fact, there's a lot of historical evidence for that. The death tolls, if you look at the early years of settlement from Europe of the United States, the death tolls were so much higher in the South, where you had malaria, you had malarial ponds everywhere, where there wasn't the freezing cold that killed bacteria off in the wintertime. So those are some of the reasons. The Federalist Papers, 51. This is separation of powers, I think. You're now testing my memory.
Is it separation of powers, Harry?
No, it's mainly about factions. He had this, he didn't
factions?
Like political factions.
Oh, okay. Political factions.
Oh, factions. Oh, that's a really good point. In Federalist 51... Is it 51? Okay. Madison takes on the old idea that factions are terrible. I suppose people felt about factions then as many people feel about political parties now. But Madison's idea was that what was bad about factions could be seen as a good thing. If you had a sufficient number of factions, a sufficient number of people with different interests, it would be very hard for any one of those factions to dominate, to become tyrannical. So I think it was breakthrough thinking in a way because it provided a theoretical base for establishing a large republic, which is what the people who wrote the Constitution were about. I also love just the story of Madison, who was then a friend of Hamilton's, and how fast they wrote the Federalist Papers, how smart they were, how much they knew. Madison once wrote, how does this go, 22 of the Federalist essays in 40 days.
No.
And
oh
I love
gosh.
To tell college students that and say, you know, you could probably do that, I could probably do that, but what we wrote wouldn't be immortal, which
right.
the Federalist Papers are.
Ooh, well, he had prepared himself for that. Mm-hmm. He also, when you were talking, you write about Princeton, that he probably worked himself into a bit of a nervous breakdown at Princeton. He was trying to do 2 years of work in 1 year. He never went to sleep. He was working all the time. He was exhausted.
Well, you know, I believe that that's where he had his first seizure.
Oh.
And if you study epilepsy as much as I have, and I've been really fortunate to talk to one of the top people in the country about epilepsy, one of the things you learn is that sleep deprivation is a cue for a seizure. So I my explanation of what happened is that he deprived himself of sleep. He had a seizure, and that led to this. He couldn't travel home. He stayed on extra time at Princeton because, you know, he felt he was too frightened, I think, to travel home. And to this deep despondency because, you know, he knew what had happened to him, and the way his society explained it was it meant he was evil. It meant he was sinful.
More phone calls for Lynn Cheney in a moment. She is the author of lots of books, but the one we're talking about is James Madison, A Life Reconsidered, our fourth president. 800-486-8655 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation about Madison. We would like to hear from you. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim in Green Bay, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
We've followed Lynn since her Madison days, and our book club took up this book.
Oh.
And I wanted to make a couple comments on the book and then a question. I think that the book is so well written that the deep scholarship may be lost to many of the readers, but she brought up so many things that when we read the other books about the Founding Fathers, Madison was mentioned, but it was like his height, I think. He was kind of an afterthought in the other books. Mm-hmm. And he comes out to be perhaps the most important of all of them. Because of the coordinating role that he played. My question deals with the parallel between then when you had so many competing interests and today, and how the impact that he, as an astute politician, could and did play, and whether that's possible and whether she sees that being done today.
So, Jim, do I know you?
Yeah, I think you do.
Oh, I do know you. Well, anyway, Dick sends you his regards. People often ask me what Madison would think if he came back today. I think his first and overwhelming reaction would be that he would find the size and scope of the federal government appalling. He began his career by thinking we needed a strong federal government because the states were all charging off in their own direction and coining money whenever they felt like it and conducting their own foreign policies. But once he saw Alexander Hamilton at work, and Alexander Hamilton was persuading Washington that George Washington, that the federal government could do just about anything it wanted, he thought that the Constitution itself was in danger. He said something like, "We might as well throw the parchment out." And so he worked. The reason that he and Thomas Jefferson founded an opposing political party was because of what Hamilton was convincing Washington to do in terms of enlarging the power of government. So I think that would be his main reaction. I don't know what he would see as the solution. It seems that the factions that want a stronger federal government, there are ever so many of those and perhaps fewer that want the federal government to step back. But I think he would think that hope for the future would lie in the citizens engaged in those factions holding their ground and increasing their numbers.
Thanks, Jim, so much. Must be satisfying to know that people are having book clubs reading your book, Lynn.
Oh, excellent. I love it. Well,
yeah,
and
it's nice.
And I don't want to embarrass Jim or say anything inappropriate, but he's married to someone I like very much, so be sure to tell her hello.
This is all very cryptic, but okay. We'll pass along that message.
Well, this is from graduate school days at Madison.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Where we all lived in... Oh, gosh, I can't remember the name of it, but it was student housing for graduate students, and we made some good friends there that we remember with great fondness.
Oh, how nice to have that connection reappear. How did you happen to go to Madison, Lynn?
Well, Dick and I both wanted to go to graduate school, and he was going to study political science, and I was going to study English. And we looked for a place that was really good in both, and that's what the University of Wisconsin at Madison was. And, moreover, we were not capable of paying for, to live and to go to school at the same time, so the university gave us both teaching fellowships.
Oh.
Actually, I had a teaching fellowship. I would teach, and Dick had a research fellowship. He would do research, statistical research on various political movements and ideas.
Very nice. Thanks, Jim, so much for calling in. I'm glad you were listening this hour. Well, we have barely, and we only have a few minutes left, but we've talked about Madison's great contributions to the founding of the nation. We haven't talked very much about his presidency. Was he a great president?
You know, he had a tough presidency, partly because of the War of 1812.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the country had never gone to war under the Constitution. He served with great honor. He had the idea in mind that somehow, though there was a war, we needed to be sure that free speech was honored, that people could oppose what the government was doing. In New England, there was even talk of a separation movement, a talk of seceding from the Union. And many people urged Madison to put these people in jail. You know, they were being seditious. They weren't faithful and true to the country. Now, Madison understood that should they try to secede, that he needed troops that he could send in, and he made sure that he had that. But he also never attempted once to stop their expressing their opposition to the war. I'm not sure what John Adams had in mind, but he thought that Madison was the best president we had had in the early years of the Republic. And that was saying something because he said that Madison had done a better job than he, Adams, had done himself.
Well, that's interesting. Religion, we haven't talked much about religion, and it was important in his life in terms of religious freedom. He was very upset about the way the Baptists were treated in Virginia, I believe. I'm wondering about his religious persuasion, how he figured it should factor into government or into the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, and whether or not it's true that he has been called a deist, whatever that means, and is that what he was?
You know, it's hard to say. It's hard to put a label on. But the thing that you can be sure of is that he was, I think, the greatest proponent of religious freedom in the founding period. And I've wondered if that isn't related to the fact that, you know, he had this illness and the church is telling him,
right,
you know, you're possessed of the devil. And,
right,
and he knew that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
And he understood it simply wasn't right for someone to have to say he believed something when he didn't really believe it. And that may, I think it seems likely to me, have led to this strong belief he had that, you know, he thought that Baptists were a little too emotional. You know, he didn't want to be a Baptist, but he didn't particularly like their religion, but he certainly thought that they had a right to practice it freely. And in Virginia, they were putting Baptists in jail. And when crowds would gather to hear someone preach through the bars of the jail, officials would ride into the group with horses, and any slave caught listening would be severely whipped. So it was really bad. And Madison had the courage to speak out, and it was a theme that went through his whole life, including when he was authoring the Bill of Rights.
Lynn Cheney, thank you so much. It must have been, the work you did on this is so obvious, but what a wonderful thing to do, to walk around in that kind of person's shoes and that time in American history.
Well, thank you for asking me to be on your show. It's always fun.
Thank you. Lynn Cheney, our guest, and her book has just been released in paperback. It is titled James Madison, A Life Reconsidered. She has written other books about history, and including a number of historical books for young people and their families. We thank her for being with us. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening. News ahead. And we'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.